In their frenetic 1930 opera, The Rise and Fall of the City of Mahagoni, Kurt Weill and Bertolt Brecht satirize what they saw as the brutality and greed beneath the glitzy capitalism that had become the be-all and end-all in Germany after World War I. Those years of superficial good times and prosperity, sometimes referred to in Germany as the Golden Twenties, largely coincided with a makeshift political system known as the Weimar Republic. They were years of political polarization, hyperinflation, and increasing disregard for the German Constitution. What does Germany in those years have in common with America today? I'm Norman Gilliland.
And I'm Emily Auerbach. This is University of the Air.
Why did German politics become so extreme in the 1920s? How did it come to pass that a banknote worth $12 million in 1914 was worth just $1 9 years later? And why did Germany's parliamentary government turn into a dictatorship in just a few years? Our guest is Leonard Kaplan, professor of law and a faculty member of the Religious Studies, Comparative Literature, and Jewish Studies departments of the UW-Madison, and a fellow with the Institute for Research in the Humanities.
Welcome to University of the Air.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
I know a few years ago you did a conference along with Rudy Koshar on the Weimar Republic. Can you tell us about your interest in that time period?
What went on in my head for a long time was that we had this situation in Europe, in Germany, of the Holocaust. And it was seen to be, in much of the literature, an anomaly. That is, we had the Holocaust, and that was it. It was something very strange. Happened once, couldn't happen again. But it hit me that with all my concern about due process and politics in the United States and the liberal state and the relationship between the liberal state and the law, that what was happening in Weimar should be looked at, because it seemed to me, even at that point, before I did any kind of significant study, that it wasn't an anomaly. It was something that was potentially endemic to the liberal state itself, and it was something that could, in fact, be of a concern in the contemporary world. And I came to believe, and I still believe, that that is the case. So with Rudy Koshar, as you mentioned, we put on a conference here. It was a world conference in the sense that we had people from Germany, Israel, Canada, the United States. A book will come out of that. I'm pleased with the essays. But at the end of the day, I felt very frustrated. And why did I feel frustrated? Because it hit me that with the smartest people who were doing, or many of the smartest people who were doing this kind of research into Weimar, that if the brown shirts had come into the room at the conference in the 2.5-3 days of the conference, nobody in that room would have been as prepared or more prepared than anybody who lived through Weimar Germany. And there's a way in which it seems to me that we don't know how to tune ourselves to what's happened in the past and how to safeguard against it and how to move progressively into the future. And I think there are parallels between what happened then and what happened now, although they're obviously inexact and it's a different world today from the world it was then. But there are too many commonalities to ignore.
Well, let's go back to, let's say, 1919, the end of World War I, the signing of the treaty that ended the hostilities between Germany and the Allied powers, and the end of, I guess, Imperial Germany, too, supposedly a great step forward.
Yes, let's look at that. I think that the most recent historians are looking at that point as not as consequential, at least with respect to reparations, as we used to think. Obviously, there was a great manipulation of the masses, if you will, because of the hyperinflation that happened in Germany. The truth of the matter is the Germans demanded reparations in their own settlements previously in history in Africa. The Haitians are still laboring under reparations to France. It's one reason why the Haitians are in deep trouble. It's an old model. But I think the more recent history is that the Germans could have gotten past that if it weren't for, in fact, a series of other events that led to the kind of brutality and taking over of a very liberal constitution, if not, in fact, a liberal state.
Well, tell us something about the governmental structure in 1919 in Weimar, how the different institutions worked. Was it It sort of was a parliamentary republic, or, I mean, how did it work?
As an intellectual and as a law professor, I have to be very careful. And the reason I have to be careful is because there's all sorts of levels of history here, and I don't pretend to be an expert in all of them. My own research is that the question of the liberal state in Germany was always problematic. That is, from the very beginning, the 1880s, let's say, we were dealing with a significant conservatism in much of the structure. The intellectuals were significantly divided between the left and the right. There wasn't a very strong core in the center. What's important for today is that the German people, the mass, may have been more educated politically than our mass is, and nevertheless were easily manipulated, were not so easily manipulated by the economy and the culture, by anger, etc. But even to talk about the German Constitution, the Weimar Constitution was a very progressive document and still is. And labor and the conservatives were written into the Constitution. But the welfare state couldn't maintain itself. And there's a question in Europe today whether it can. There's a question today here whether the welfare state can contain itself, which is a parallel that we'll talk about later. But the German legal class was pretty conservative. The courts were extraordinarily conservative. There was law in the state and there was constitutional law, and the two of them were potentially conflictual. One of the key liberal jurisprudes, Hans Kelsen, wrote himself out of the game with respect to effectiveness because he saw law as a science and he divided law from politics, so he had nothing to say about the law. Hermann Heller, who was a liberal, was effective, but more effective was Carl Schmitt, who was the apologist for the Nazis and, ironically, if you will, taught many of the left-wing intellectuals their jurisprudence. And he had a notable critique of the liberal state early on and in a continued kind of way, and never got denazified, lived to about 91, 92, was visited by liberals like Raymond Aron, held seminars, and most of his work has been translated by MIT Press, so it's out there. And his critique of the liberal state is still cogent, the most important of which, I think, is this notion that what you're calling the parliament, if you will, was captured by economic interests. And I think the same point could be made today in the United States. We're conquered by not even local capital, by international capital.
Well, can you define liberal as you're using it in terms of Weimar? Because terms like liberal and conservative, you know, they have a meaning to us today, perhaps, although it's a little bit murky. But what did it mean then?
As a technical term, the liberal state has different meanings and they're conflictual. One meaning comes out of somebody like Hegel. The liberal state for Hegel essentially meant setting up a governance, a state, if you will, that would look out for the possibility of each individual flourishing, the self-actualization of each person, but recognizing capitalism, the political economy of capitalism, was key. He went to the Scottish Enlightenment for that, and that poverty was always going to be a problem, but at least the state had an obligation to take care of the flourishing of the individual. The other strand of liberalism that we can find in Hayek, but goes back to Adam Smith and the Scottish Enlightenment as well, is the sheer marketplace. Smith and his ilk were actually moral philosophers and cared about people more than the people who were behind the pure marketplace and decry state intervention into the marketplace. So one meaning of the liberal state is that the state should intervene only with respect to what is absolutely imperative, but otherwise to let the free markets, if such a thing ever existed, to maintain themselves. And the other is to make interventions on behalf of individuals who otherwise would be thwarted by structural impediments in the political economy and the culture.
So if we go back to Weimar, to Germany in 1919, and look at who is actually getting control of this new parliamentary government, who do we find?
We find conservatives. We find some organized labor. Bernstein was originally a Marxist. He was a revisionist. There were unions. Unions were included significantly in the Weimar Constitution. We find farmers. We find some industrial workers. After all, Karl Marx thought that Germany would be the significant country that would push toward his notion of communism, not Russia, for God's sakes. I mean, Karl Liebknecht and Rosa Luxemburg gave Lenin really important instruction. He didn't listen, and the world suffered. He suffered too, but that's a different subject.
So when it came to, let's say, the first elections in the Weimar Republic, any kind of majority?
For the most part, until near the end, the center left did well, but things weren't working. right? I mean, look today. I mean, the center left did well in the last election. So what? Things don't seem to be working. And we'll see what happens in the next election. How do you mobilize people? One way to get at that is an area that's part of both of your love, and that is literature, cinema. So you can trace some of this out in cinema. You can trace some of it out in literature. Berlin Alexanderplatz, for example, or Rosa and Karl, or the failure of the German Revolution. You know, when I first looked at this subject matter, I was disheartened. Why wasn't there a German Revolution? There wasn't. For a while there was no core of power that looked like it could actually work, and there were mistakes made. Now, I want to say something else about this. If you look at history structurally, everything seems to be determined, and there seems like there's no way out. But if you read the good historians, there were moments where there could have been ways out. Hitler didn't have to win, but he did. And once he won, he wasn't a Democrat. He wasn't a Republican. He took over the apparatus of the state, and that was it, until he was finally defeated, right? So right there, to get back to the point that Emily asked me to begin with, it's the limits of liberal jurisprudence, the limits of the state. At some point, the liberal state can be vulnerable to a takeover, and there could even be a Democratic vote that destroys the liberal state. And we don't have significant enough research and understanding to really obviate that or to negate that. On the other hand, it's a contradiction in the fabric of liberal values.
That you would actually vote a democratic state out of existence. Well, it's been said that Lebanon is one example of that.
Egypt could be another example of that before we're done. Saudi Arabia could be another example of that. We're not done with Iraq. All right, we're trying to make states where states didn't exist. We seem to think that states are the best form of governance. We seem to be against tribalism. From my point of view, we have a notion of history that's part of our own cultural ideology that may not be as progressive or as effective as we should have it. We don't learn from history, if anybody ever can learn from history.
Well, one of the mistakes that the Weimar Republic made, although I don't know what other solution there might have been, was that in response to a need for money to pay reparations, for example, for World War I, they simply printed more money.
That's where your hyperinflation comes from. But we've had other examples in the world of hyperinflation that haven't resulted in a Hitler. I don't know that it was necessary. I do think that there was a kind of bifurcation. And I'd like to hear more about that from people who are more expert than I am. That is, the left and the right weren't going to do business together. If you remember Yeats, the center does not hold. That didn't come out of thin air, right? The center did not hold. And frequently the center doesn't hold. And why doesn't the center hold? Because it's compromise. It's wishy-washy. It doesn't stand for something precise. It has to do with negotiation in some ways. Patience in some way in which people don't get what they want. And it's long been the case that people with real intensity, even though they're in minority, if they're a significant enough percentage, can carry the day against huge numbers in the middle who don't have the same kind of enthusiasm or the same kind of organization.
No question about that. Certainly would apply to Hitler. But it seems that a lot of history is made through polarization, because that's where you get your action, as you're implying that. I mean, if you think of the American Revolution, there was no center there for very long. It was all a matter of radicals on one side versus, you know, the conservatives in the homeland on the other. And the Civil War very quickly became radicalized, polarized. Just by the nature of these things, people have to eventually line up on one side or the other, whether they necessarily subscribe to or like those extremes.
For the most part, I agree with you. But the reason I even want to think about that is that we don't know all the other times in history where that didn't happen.
Right, because they don't become
the center of the historical discourse.
Right.
So what do we look at? We look at crisis moments.
Right, exactly.
You know, and that's a problem.
Radical
that's a problem.
Yeah.
Well, back to the hyperinflation. Can we talk a little bit about the psychological effect that had on the German people? Because if you have your savings overnight worthless, it could, I think, foster a sense of panic, you know, sort of make it so that a leader then can come along and perhaps have more effect than he otherwise would. Can you talk a little bit about how that sort of when an economy tanks, what that can do to people and their vulnerabilities?
Well, you know, it's important to have an enemy. So it was possible to make France the enemy, demand for reparations. The French and Germans didn't have a very good history to begin with, as one example. So it was possible to mobilize over that issue. You know, all of Europe had a history of anti-Semitism for all sorts of reasons, but it was possible to make Jews the enemy.
And communists? Right?
And well, you know, communists, the socialists even in Europe today have some significant power, right? They don't conflate socialism and communism quite so readily. So I don't know about that. Yes, to some extent. The other thing that was going on was nationalism. Nationalism is very late in the day. But nationalism became a rallying point. It's a rallying point in the world today. So in World War I, you had all sorts of people that in Germany who you would have expected to be cosmopolitan, who were very committed to German politics, fought in the war. Many Jews were horrified to find out when Hitler took power that they were not considered to be first-rate Germans because they had medals from fighting in World War I and their people and their family had. They didn't get it. They just didn't get it because they were thoroughly German. So nationalism becomes another very important issue here. Somebody like Hannah Arendt writes about this, and then Celia Ben-Habib, who's going to be on campus from the Humanities Center and the workshop I'm doing with Rudy on Reason and Revelation in the fall, right? And others are writing on this as well. So this is becoming, has been, a very thoroughly studied area. But I don't know that inflation by itself triggered that. And, you know, Emily, with respect to your question, I lost a lot of money, right, when the economy here tanked. And I didn't have a whole lot to lose, and I'm in better shape than a whole lot of other people who lost a lot of money. I have no doubt that both of you guys lost a lot of money, and it hasn't come back, because it only comes back for the super rich. It doesn't come back for the middle class. So, in fact, in the United States, the middle class is taking the kind of battering that we saw in Weimar as well.
Did we see class strife in Weimar? I mean, sometimes when you have a revolution, it's the wealthy who become the scapegoats and the masses rise up, like, you know, France, I suppose, would be an example of that, and usurp power from the wealthy. Did we see that kind of class conflict in the Weimar Republic?
You know, there was a class conflict, but I don't know that was determinative. I really don't. I mean,
it was really more a matter of nationalism.
I think it was nationalism. I think that you put your finger on it. Hyperinflation didn't help. We have a world right now where there's terror in Europe about potential hyperinflationism to the point where people are concerned about stagflation in Europe today. We know that the world is very heavily under credit. Whatever credit means, right? We've believed in Keynesianism. We don't know if it's going to work. Right. We, you know, I'm behind Obama with respect to stimulation, but nobody knows for sure. Our economists get Nobel Prizes, but it's more of an art than a science, it seems to me. And it's not, that's not faulting them. The complexity is absolutely extraordinary. Right. Absolutely extraordinary. And we're seeing that. Look, one point I want to make today are limits. Limits on law, limits on the state, limits most particularly on critical thought and knowledge. And even when we have knowledge, it's not clear to me that we know how to apply the knowledge that we have.
Well, that's been demonstrated certainly if you're looking at intelligence, you know, and the notorious weapons of mass destruction, everybody kind of giving their best guesses to how to proceed with that information or lack thereof.
A German sociologist, Max Weber, said that the gap between what we know and what we can do is significant. Roberta Unger, who is one of the fathers of critical legal studies, and picking up on Weber, said the same thing. We have what, if you want a fancy philosophical word, we have an antinomy. We have a contradiction. We know a lot more about what to do than we actually put into existence, right? As a contemporary example, Obama puts a moratorium together on deep ocean drilling. Right. Well, that makes total sense because we don't know that the whales that we've given licenses to won't do the same thing that's happened. On the other hand, there's only two industries, as I understand it, in Louisiana. One's fishing, oystering, all of that, and the other is oil. Well, how are we going to feed people if they can't do oil and if they can't do fishing?
Let alone turn the wheels for everybody else.
I mean exactly that. All the contingent industries, the tourism, the hotel industries as part of that, the entertainment industries. I mean, all of the above.
So you're saying you can know about a problem, but you obviously can't always take care of it.
My wife read a book that came out a long time ago on the Mississippi and its implication down to New Orleans. They knew a long time ago, and it had to do with the politics of the time, that Katrina was likely to happen. They've known it for a long time. Part of the frustration I have as a lawyer was, unlike some intellectuals, lawyers want to do something in the world. All right, it's not merely theoretical. Is the Weberian insight that we know a lot, but we don't seem to have either the will or the knowledge to be effective implementers of our knowledge. Now, sometimes it's what Carl Schmitt said. Sometimes it's because our institutions have sold themselves out. You may have seen in the news yesterday that Halliburton is putting huge money into Congress. That's going to make a difference. Do either of you think that BP, British Petroleum, will end up paying even a quarter on a dollar for their damage, even though they say they'll take care of it? I don't. And then you have pedestrian interests that aren't quite so pedestrian. Alabama and Florida are concerned about their beaches. That's a tourist industry, right? Meanwhile, the estuaries are going to hell, and it's not clear they'll ever come back, which means oysters.
Yeah, and that, I see, has also sparked a controversy between what you might call the people concerned about industry versus the ones concerned with environment. In other words, you save the beaches for industry, tourist industry in this case, or do you save those estuaries for environmental purposes, assuming you can't do both immediately? So these things become politicized.
How do you do the cost-benefit? We have some really smart people doing middle-order law and economics. It's a very difficult proposition. These are frequently zero-sum games. The compromises are very difficult. It's not clear where we have the technology to do anything effective. It may be that all we're doing is something symbolic. And that's another aspect of the liberal state. You know, there's an old Phil Oakes song in the 60s, love me, I'm a liberal. What do? We identify an issue. And then we put together a commission. Then we put together a white paper from the commission. And then we forget it. Barrington Moore called that the commodification of moral outrage. What's the commodification of moral outrage? We have a particular social problem that has hegemony or a concern. And then we address it with symbolic legislation. And then we let it pass. I mean, I can show you, it's been done, chapter and verse about black lung and about miners. Going back until, 1880, 1870, the situation is still the same. We have all the legislation on the books we need, both locally, that is in the states, and federally. It still doesn't make a difference.
And you link that somehow to the way things were with Weimar?
Oh, I think that Schmitt's point there was right. I mean, one danger of the liberal state has been that we don't pay enough attention to individual flourishing a la Weber and pay more attention to the civil religion of the marketplace, which is not Adam Smith, but is more like Hayek. And I think Hayek is probably misquoted there, too. And we have this notion that the free market will operate. What was good for Bill Bulmus will be good for all the rest of us, you know, which was the old game.
Yes.
But now we're finding that it is the case that when the government gets into things, it frequently screws them up. But now we're finding out the marketplace does the same thing. Now what we can do is turn to religion and start to pray, which is not going to be very effective in terms of preserving oysters or crabs. So maybe that's one for orthodoxy. We shouldn't eat lobsters and oysters and crabs that come out of those estuaries.
Not for a while, I suspect.
More on Weimar then and now when we continue in a moment with University of the Year.
I'm Norman Gilliland, back with Emily Auerbach. And our guest, Leonard Kaplan, and he is comparing Weimar Germany, Germany between the two world wars, this faltering democratic experiment, with the situation in today's America, finding parallels and presumably some things that do not line up too. But we have been talking a fair amount about the problem of inflation in the Weimar Republic and how that polarized political thinking. There were also the disregards for the constitution that had been put together for the Weimar Republic. It seemed that there was a kind of a systematic way of actually short-circuiting that constitution for political expediency.
Yeah. One way in which we have to be very cautious about comparing and contrasting Weimar with the United States is that Weimar never had a civil religion that was committed to a constitution. They had a law of state and they had constitutional law. The two of them were conflictual, and the extent to which the German courts were going to intervene, they were going to intervene based on the law of state, and the law of state wasn't the constitution and it wasn't going to come out in any progressive kind of way. So there wasn't the commitment to the constitution by the masses as we see here. I mean, as an example, whatever the Supreme Court had to say about the right to bear arms, that right is so part of individual culture in different parts of our country that you couldn't take it back under any circumstance. We had a little cabin up in the North Woods, loved the North Woods, loved the people up there, and everybody had a gun, and everybody was taught to have a gun at very early ages. They knew how to carry a gun. And to talk about carrying a gun in the North Woods is very different from talking about a Saturday night special in inner city Chicago. So sometimes, at least in the United States, parts of the Constitution are engrammed in people's consciousness, for good and bad, right? I don't think that was ever the case in Weimar. And we didn't have the intellectual commitment behind the Weimar Constitution by the judiciary or by the bar, from what I can tell. And as a matter of fact, Carl Schmitt was arguing that politics were more significant than law. Politics would trump law. The sovereign was bigger than the law. The sovereign can do what the sovereign wanted to do, no matter what the law had to say.
Well, that starts to sound kind of fascist, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah, well, it also sounds like Abraham Lincoln during the Civil War.
Well, sure. He was a dictator for a time.
Suspending habeas corpus.
What kind of checks and balances were in place?
So there were no checks and balances.
No checks and balances at all?
No, not really. The checks and balances would have been whatever civil society could have been on checks and balances. What would that have been? It would have been the Protestant Church. The Protestant Church went Nazi very quickly. Suzanne Heschel has done a significant bit of research on that, a new book out on how that church folded except for the Confessing Church, which was very small, Bonhoeffer. Bart left Germany, so it was a very small opposition there. The Catholics weren't particularly effective in standing against Hitler. The Jews, there was no legitimacy there to begin with. The Gypsies, all right? Islam had no beachhead in Germany. They have more of a beachhead today than they had then.
What about the court?
The courts essentially didn't, you know, the extent to which they cared, they weren't committed to a constitution. It wasn't, that's what I'm saying.
So let's say you have a court in place in the Weimar Republic, and then you have a leader who is taking too much power or ignoring the Constitution. Did the court not have a way to?
There was an emergency clause, and the question was the court going to go for Prussia against the nation state or for the nation state? And Prussia, I think, was more progressive at that particular point, and that's not the way the court went, right? Which was no big surprise. Part of my interest was what was going on legally then. And I asked people who command German and were, you know, jurisprudes, there was no doctrine in the lower courts or middle order or even higher courts that would have really constrained what happened. We have a much thicker jurisprudence today. But even today, Supreme Court has said that a corporation has free speech. An international corporation has free speech to the point where they could put as much money into campaigns as they want to put into campaigns. Well, what's the check on that? I think that case is potentially the Dred Scott case of the 21st century. When I first started teaching law, there would have been a hue and cry in American law schools. There would have been all sorts of petitions signed. It would have made the New York Times. It would have been published in the New York Times, all the signatures. Nothing. I talked to colleagues of mine around the country. The law schools have opted out that way. Now, do law professors, aren't they as smart? Sure. Do they think it's a bad decision? Sure. Are they talking amongst each other? Sure. On email, on fact lists. But it's disconnected from any kind of real consequential matter. Now, the interesting thing about liberal jurisprudence is if corporations are people, and if they have free speech, maybe in places where there's a death sentence, they could be killed. Right? And maybe we can have BP up for a death sentence. The only problem with that, this takes us back to the law and economics point. We put BP out of power. That means more business for Shell and Exxon.
Right.
You know, is that a good?
Well, and that gets into another question too, and that is, sure, you have corporate power in this country and in other countries too, but And it can be abused. It has been abused. It will be abused. But does that mean you do away with the corporations, or are they a necessary thing, whether you call them a necessary evil or not? Aren't you shooting yourself in the foot eventually if you deprive yourself of any kind of corporate structure in this country? But on the question of the corporation's ability to have free speech, is that really parallel to the individual's free speech? I mean, there's no are there fewer restrictions on corporate free speech than there are on individual free speech?
We're going to find out. This is a body of law that's going to develop, and it could well depend on who is on the court. And right now, the balance on the court is not a balance that is looking out for the individual. Let me go back to a comment you just made about doing in corporations, international corporations. It's not the issue. The issue is international corporations are going to do in the nation state. I mean, they're much more powerful. They have their own private armies. I don't care what you call Black Order. It changes its name. It could change its name 10 times over again. They get hired to protect corporate interests in places like Africa. They can be hired any place. No, my model of the corporation, if you will, is Ian Fleming, right? Now, what do I mean by that? Smersion Spectra. Mm-hmm. I mean, international corporate formation does not depend upon local sovereignties. It is very difficult to get at these people if they want to move. They can move into Mexico City. They can move out of Mexico City. They can be in Europe. They could be outside of Europe. Let's do a thought experiment. If, in fact, all the data going in and out of Wall Street and trading went down for 4 minutes, could you put Humpty Dumpty back together again? I mean, it's all that fluid.
Right.
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 I don't even know how you begin to regulate that in effective kinds of ways.
Well, and we saw that recently, that what was it, about a 1,000-point drop because somebody apparently misplaced a decimal point somewhere.
Well, that's what we're told. I was told a long time ago by people who are historians that if there is a conspiracy or if there is a move that's a corrupt move and it's caught, the first thing you say is that was stupidity or that was a mistake.
Well, that brings me to a question about the media, because a lot of the information that we receive comes through newspapers, internet sources, television, and so on. We're kind of at the mercy of the reporters in terms of what we're fed. Can you give us some kind of comparison about the way the media worked in the Weimar Republic and the way it works now?
You guys are more expert than I am about that, but you have constraints on your station in terms of what you can cover, and you have maybe some fewer constraints than some. Murdoch owns Fox, and he's been a good partner to Berlusconi in Italy. We know what Berlusconi's been able to do in Italy. We knew the newspapers are not hiring reporters. We know it doesn't go very deep in terms of investigative reporting. We know that much of what comes out is coming out of the blogs and coming out of internet. I look to the internet frequently for information. We have a whole generation of students and people in general who look for knowledge in Wikipedia. You know, I mean, Wikipedia, that's going to be something that's valid in terms of real commitment, real policing. I mean, it's always been a problem. I think it's a deeper problem now. There's more information out there, but how to judge that information is very difficult. And then on top of which, as we polarize our polity, if you could even call it a polity, people choose sides. So some of us will listen to MSNBC. Some will listen to Fox. We had a woman who's a very solid newspaper reporter and communicator who just resigned from CNN because she lost her audience in terms of reporting straight news. Nobody wants to listen.
They want to listen with the media outlet with which they agree, too.
Well,
they're not really that open to contrary points of view.
I mean, you know, I get more out of John Stewart or Bill Maher in terms of even fair discourse. When there's panelists on Bill Maher, at least, you know, there's some interchange that has some intelligence. It's reduced to a joke. Now, here's a point. You started with Brecht and Weil. Brecht had a theoretical move, I think, that was really important, and that was he wanted to use the arts for teaching people politically. But I think we're post-Brecht. That is, when I was 23, 24, younger, I went to a movie, a foreign movie, quote-unquote, an art movie, and a bunch of us had gone, and we would, for hours, go and have a coffee and talk about the movie. Now I go with friends, even a good movie. By the time we leave the theater, we're done talking about it. Everything has been turned into aesthetics, and it's very difficult to take any of this understanding and turn it into politics. in any effective kind of way. And we can see that with the BP thing. I'll come back to that as a paradigm. I want everybody who's listening, and myself, and listen to myself included, to here's my prediction. We won't get a quarter on a dollar from BP. And if Obama's administration loses, the new administration will make sure that nothing comes from that. Supreme Court of the United States cut back on the liability from the Valdez. We have the information. We have all the white papers. We knew this was going to happen. We know it's going to happen again. Right?
And would you say the reason that we would not get more than a quarter on a dollar is because the corporations are able to sort of run the show, or because business interests are being protected, or what would
be
the reason?
They're one and the same. They're one and the same. I mean, I don't want to say the politicians are bought, because it's not a question of buying. They're already there. I mean, people have their ideologies. And if you have an ideology that's a marketplace ideology, then you're not going to go against BP. All right? I'm only using BP as an example. I mean, we had Love Canal. All right? Look, you know, remember Pogo? We met the enemy, and the enemy's us.
Yes.
I drive an old 95 Infiniti. I love it. I'm burning gas. I can't afford anything that would be comparable in terms of an automobile. It's a fine automobile. Right? We're all into it. We all abuse this. People in the United States use more than our fair share. We're going to get into wind? Ha ha. Not so quickly. And I have a friend who's an environmental sociologist, and I asked him a long time ago about solar. And he laughed. He said, well, if we do solar in the United States, what we'll do is put one big magnifying glass between us and the sun and incinerate everything. Right? I mean, so part of it is cultural. It's deeper than merely the evil corporation. I'm not against capitalism. I'm not for planned economies, for God's sakes. We saw what happened in the Soviet Union for that. Right? That didn't work. One more statement about this. People talk about left and right. I'm not sure there is a thoughtful conservatism, and I damn well know that there's not a thoughtful center-left position. It's just not there. Or if it's there, please somebody tell me.
By thoughtful, you mean that's actually
coherent, doable, something other than where the rubber can hit the road, where people understand why they're where they are. So we have these mixed bags. I'm not saying you can't find correlations, all right? We have somebody, was it Cameron, running for the Republican gubernatorial position in California, who's taking a hit because he's pro-choice. Otherwise, he's a social liberal economic conservative. We used to call those Northeastern Republicans with Javits, et cetera, and Western Republicans. They cease to exist. We'll see what happens with Scott Brown. It'd be nice to see some of his people back. We used to have Lyndon Johnson and Everett Dirksen being able to do politics together. We don't have that.
No, that certainly has been said, hasn't it, that the conciliatory, cooperative atmosphere in Congress.
Okay, so your bottom line with respect to the media is such that we don't respect it. We don't expect anything from it yet. In fact, they're into our bones. I don't think there's anybody who hasn't walked up State Street if you're in Madison, or been in a car, or been someplace where a stupid jingle comes into your head from some corporation and you don't even like the corporation. It's in our bones and we can't get rid of it, but it's very hard to find an Edward R. Murrow or a Cronkite or any figure, center left, center right, that we have deep respect for and can stand up and be avuncular. And what's the word for an ant? You know, a smart ant. We need that word too. You know, I mean, feminism wins when we have a smart ant.
Well, Edward R. Murrow wound up doing fluff pieces, too, before it was all over, and there had to be some reason behind that, too, having to do with commercialism.
Yeah, we have to eat.
Well, there's always ratings.
To make a buck, and who knows, maybe Murdoch will end up buying out the New York Times before it's over, too.
We'll be looking further at these parallels or divergences, if you will, between the Weimar Republic and contemporary America when we return in a moment. This is University of the Air. The Supreme Court, despite its look of somber, black-robed fairness, was doing its bit for the ruling elite. How could it be independent, with its members chosen by the president and ratified by the Senate? How could it be neutral between rich and poor when its members were often former wealthy lawyers and almost always came from the upper class? Early in the 19th century, the court laid the legal basis for a nationally regulated economy by establishing federal control over interstate commerce. and the legal basis for corporate capitalism by making the contract sacred.
That's a passage from Howard Zinn's People's History of the United States. I'm Emily Auerbach, back with Norman Gilliland. Our guest is Leonard Kaplan, and we're talking about the Weimar Republic and parallels between that time period between First World War and the Second World War in Germany and today. Let's start with that idea of the judiciary and whether the Supreme Court is really independent or not, both in Weimar and then today.
Independent of what? It's a nice quote from Zinn, but why would any U.S. institution be independent of U.S. culture? That would be the height of foolishness to believe that. Now, having said that, there have been judges on the Supreme Court of the United States and indeed presidents who defied their class interests. We call that noblesse oblige. It's frequently the case that the upper class turns out to have more sympathy for the lower class, or somebody like Hugo Black, who turned out, from my point of view, to be a great jurist, was a member of the Ku Klux Klan in his early days. So we can't always predict. I want to make a different kind of point. I think that the courts today are significantly political. I think they've always been significantly political, sometimes surprisingly progressive, very often not. To have hope that the Supreme Court would stand up for the individual has always been problematic. For my generation, it was because we had a hiatus, if you will, with the Warren Court. But before that and after that, we haven't had notably progressive Supreme Court. There's something else going on today, though, that generalizes beyond the courts, and I'll get back to the courts in a moment, and that's the question of transparency. I think today our institutions are more transparently controlled by significant interests than we could identify the interests, more than we used to be able to do. Now, that's, from my point of view, is that a good or a bad? I grew up as a professor, as an intellectual, thinking that if we had transparency and we had more transparency, we'd be in better shape. In fact, my first law review article was demanding transparency in medicine and in psychiatry, the so-called informed consent. 30 years afterwards, I gave a paper on that where I demanded informed consent from doctors, and I had to reconsider that. And what hit me was when I was attacking doctors for informed consent, I was missing the point. It was hospitals and then insurance companies that were controlling everything, and it wasn't a question of informed consent. All right. And I said that. And afterwards, I had a young professor come up to me and said, "You impugn Jay Katz." Well, I had taken a course from Jay Katz at Yale Law School on that very matter, and he had convinced me about the necessity of transparency. He was a psychiatrist. Right. And this guy said to me, "I'm going to go back and tell Jay about what you said." And I found that very amusing. And I said to him, I said, "You know what? I think that's a good idea. And you do it real soon, because I'm seeing Jay next week when I'm visiting my son up at Yale. And Jay and I could talk about it." And Jay and I did talk about it. And we laughed because we both knew that, in fact, that transparency wasn't going to work. Okay, we have transparency with BP right now. The Wisconsin Supreme Court has been taken over by the Wisconsin Manufacturers Association in terms of the kind of money you could pour in. O'Connor, who's not notably a lefty, has said that we shouldn't have election for judges. We should have appointments. That's not an answer either. There is no procedural answer, because if you have the wrong governor, then the appointment's going to be just as sour as what the electorate gives us. I don't see an easy answer to this. We have Butler, who lost an election that he shouldn't have lost because of mendacity on the Supreme Court of Wisconsin. He's been given an appointment at the district court level, and we have Pauls in Wisconsin putting a hold on his appointment. The guy is judicial. He's prudent. He might be slightly center-left. You don't get an appointment if you're more than that. He deserves to be on the court, and he's being killed. Our judiciary has become bought in many places. Is it going to hold up? Yeah, it could hold up. Look at Bush versus Gore.
How can you prove that our judiciary is being bought? I mean, I'm just going to play devil's advocate for a minute here and say, well, so this is your opinion. You don't like certain decisions that were made with judges. How can you prove that the state Supreme Court here in Wisconsin is bought?
I've talked to ex-bar heads in Wisconsin, and they agree with that. Take a look at the money that was poured in by the Wisconsin Manufacturers Association and see how that was worked. People understand that the ads run against Butler were mendacious. If that's too heavy a word, lies.
Well, so you're saying if a case came before the Wisconsin Supreme Court that involved the Wisconsin Manufacturers Association, it would be a really tough slog for any plaintiff against that. organization.
I think that's right, but I don't know that it's because the judges are going to look at one side versus another. They're going to look structurally, and that's where they are to begin with. So it's not a question of necessarily an evil intent. They gave me the money, and therefore I have to vote their way. It's more that they share a worldview. And that worldview gets put into actualization. So there's limits on liability. Let's take a look at something that's going to come before the Supreme Court. Is the Supreme Court of the United States going to uphold the right for the Walmart women to have a class action? It's not so clear to me that they will. Do they deserve a class action? If you want to stop Walmart from, if they're doing it, I think they are, biasing women in the workplace, the only way to effectively stop them is with a class action. At least that's one effective way, unless you get legislation. If the Supreme Court turns that around, then you've lost that remedy. That's people being private attorneys general. And we lose that, we lose a lot. We lose legitimacy for the state. See, that's the problem that people don't understand. That is that it's a very conservative position I'm taking right now. How's it conservative? If you want to conserve the liberal state, you make sure that people don't feel disaffected. You make sure that they feel at least they're getting maybe not as much as they should, but some share of the pie. It's called legitimation. And one of the significant issues today is the question of legitimation. Now, let's say, Emily, I didn't answer your question. But my point of view is a point of view that's shared by a significant number of people. So at the level of legitimation, there's enough people who share my point of view, whether it's right or wrong, that it makes things very dangerous, potentially.
I have another question taking us back to the Weimar Republic. And, you know, one of the things that we think of in that when we think about that era is the cabaret culture, a certain kind of decadence, a certain art form. Do you see any parallels between the art and pop culture of Weimar in Germany at that time and what we see today?
To some extent, there are some people on the right, and this is not the whole right, and this is not necessarily conservatives, who are against any kind of pleasure at all. Right, they're against sexuality, they're against homosexuality. They see that as the camel's nose in the door toward real decadence, degradation, a loss of civilization. Well, on the other hand, if you remember in the 60s, Herbert Marcuse wrote a book called Eros and Civilization. Norman O. Brown wrote a book, Life Against Death. They both claimed that if you released sexuality, it would change politics. Not true. Not true, right? I mean, what we've done is fetishize the orgasm. So everybody has a right to an orgasm. Wonderful. We've empowered a lot of sexologists and therapists to be able to ensure that. I don't know what kind of impact it has. What I can tell you from my point of view is that we're living in a renaissance in the sense that there are more good novels, more good movies, more good entertainment, more good music in the world than there ever has been before. I would never have to do anything but listen to the music I already own or the music I have that at my fingertips and read the novels I have at my fingertips to be entertained forever with high-class entertainment. So to play the Weimar Cabaret game, Weimar Cabaret had a decadent side to it but also had a very significant critical side to it.
This opera, by the way, the Mahagoni that we started with was banned shortly after it was first performed in 1930. It was banned under the Hitler chancellorship.
Well, Nolde, who was an expressionist, was, I believe, to begin with a Nazi. He was horrified to find out that his work was being banned.
Final question for you. If we're trying to learn from Weimar and we don't want the rise of a Hitler, what is it that we should learn?
That's a wonderful question. Can we learn from history? Frequently, we don't learn from history. Frequently, the old saw, the history repeats itself, blah, blah, blah. We all know the old shibboleths. But we also know that the generals always fight the last war. I think the answer is to understand the limits of law and legislation, to make as many contacts with as many voluntary associations and other kinds of associations as possible. So all the Christian associations should have contact with each other and with Jewish associations and with Islamic associations and with Rotary and with Kiwanis and with, you know, other interest groups, with people who support Madison Opera, NPR. In other words, the thicker the civil society is, the more constraint there is in terms of moving in and usurping power in ways that derogation of any kind of basic civility.
Including disinformation.
Including disinformation. So I think at that level, I'm optimistic. That's not original with me. Jeffrey Alexander, a sociologist at Yale, has a book that thick. You can't see my fingers here, but it's very heavy. But I just summed it up. Let's thicken our civil society. Let's thicken the contacts we have with one another. Let's recognize where we agree and where we disagree, where we say, wait a minute, look, you know, I don't agree with the Tea Partiers, but they have a reason to be angry. Let's understand that we have to educate people, but we can't throw money away. We can't afford any more $200 screwdrivers to Halliburton. You know, we're wasting a lot of money for no good reason. We don't have it to waste anymore. All right? At the same time, if we take away basic services, if we take away policing and we take away education, we take away fire prevention, we're going to be in worse shape. It's a vicious circle. And we know we're doing that with IMF. If I take an example in Greece, I don't think anybody thinks the Greeks are going to pay back a nickel or a dollar.
Apparently not.
You know, I mean, so that's going to be a hit. And the Greeks, they're not lazy. They live a different lifestyle. They think the Northern Europeans are insane to work the way they're working. All right? And am I defaming the Greeks? Not at all. I'd like to learn how they can live and have the pleasure they have. I mean, you know, we're all too high strung. We should learn from the Greeks.
It does make you wonder a little bit how this is purely imaginary, of course, but how the Weimar Republic would have developed if they had had something like the internet where communication was so rife in the population, for better or worse, as we said earlier, Len. There's inaccurate information on the internet as well as solid information. And, of course, the Hitlers of the world have been known to succeed very well because of mass communication of a kind, you know, radio in particular. But you wonder how a really, really communicative populace then would have reacted differently to the things they were being told.
If you had intelligent, thoughtful, prudent work out there. The problem is that's not who people want to listen to. People like to be entertained. And I mean, I don't look at sludge on the net, but I look at Huffington. We all pick the sources we want to pay attention to. I mean, I turn the dial very quickly when it comes to Fox. You know, I mean, I put up the cross. I mean, these are the werewolves and vampires for me. You know, I'll listen to CNN, but CNN's not what Turner put together originally. You had Daniel Schorr on CNN originally. You had something to the center left. You had something to the center right. You had a bigger marketplace. Now we have these boutiques, and people listen to the boutiques. So if you could tell me that people would be educated by listening to different points of view, that would be wonderful. But I don't think that's what would have happened. I don't think that's what's happening today.
Our guest has been Leonard Kaplan. Len, thanks for being with us.
It's been a pleasure.
I'm Emily Auerbach with Norman Gilliland, hoping you'll be with us for the next hour of University of the Year.
Next Sunday afternoon at 4 during University of the Air, our two guests will fill us in about a disease that afflicts not that many, 30,000 Americans, and yet, for reasons we'll discover, has quite a bit of awareness. Cystic fibrosis, next Sunday afternoon at 4 here on Wisconsin Public Radio.